Strange and sometimes wonderful things can happen when your Twitter handle is @Hawaii. For the man who belongs to that username, the Twitter storm that erupted after a Hawaii judge blocked the Trump travel ban brought him into a series of exchanges that took on lives and hashtags of their own. Ryan Ozawa, who is half of the Bite Marks Cafe duo, sat down with me late yesterday to talk about how it started and why he wrote back.
I think in almost every exchange, whether on social media or in real life, you might come into a situation very angry and full of rage. And then when you realize that there's a human being on the other end, you change. You have an opportunity to change, whether it's an angry email you sent to a company or an angry tweet. When somebody responds and they're just another person, I think that that opens the door for empathy and understanding. So all of the people that I know who are engaging with a lot of this conversation on Twitter are doing the same thing. I mean, certainly they're clapping back, they're making jokes back and puns back, but in a way you're kind of saying there's life here on this side too, right? And I think that whether it's someone who has the right or wrong Twitter handle or just someone who's hearing that conversation, that opportunity for a conversation is the best part of it. When the travel ban was announced and there was just this eruption of response, both for and against, I was sort of just enjoying that kind of flood of responses. I mean, it's great to see such a wide range of responses, but some of them obviously were just almost begging for a response. You know, I mean, if it's somebody just blowing off steam, that's one thing. But someone with a large following or someone that has a lot of influence, I would be a little more sensitive to. So there was one particular tweet by someone who basically said, you know, Hawaii should let the people on the mainland run things, you know, let the grown-ups run things. You were 5,000 miles away from 9/11, so you just don't get it.
Right.
And anybody with any historical context could see there were a number of things wrong with that statement or that assumption, and it was impossible to resist not to say something.
Right. The tweet actually runs, Hawaii, what do you know? You were 5,000 miles from 9/11. You run your little world and let the grown-ups run the mainland. Very clearly, someone who has no historical perspective whatsoever, or maybe even an understanding of any sort of history at all that involves Hawaii and the Second World War.
Absolutely. I mean, we do know about attacks, and we also know about the inappropriate response to that, but perhaps an understandable one. You know, the executive order, you know, requiring Japanese Americans to be interned. My dad was born in an internment camp, and that's what I feel people should see, specifically with this travel ban and what it's trying to say and what the possible ramifications on the negative side of it could be. So it was almost perfectly teed up in that respect, a statement like that.
It's also a great opportunity to be able to teach some more about Hawaii, because very clearly there are still so many people who don't understand Hawaii, who have these, you know, ideas of what we do and how we dress and how we talk, all of these things which are laughable when you live here, but to somebody who is on the mainland who has, you know, so little but passing acquaintance with Hawaii, that's perhaps a chance to have a teaching moment.
I think that that's absolutely correct. I mean, even when things are hunky-dory, people have very interesting ideas about Hawaii. They make the same stereotypical comments about beaches and Mai Tais and pineapples, right? When people get angry, I would say, just like even in elementary school, those stereotypes get amplified tenfold. So on one hand, a lot of the responses kind of pound on those so hard, but on the other hand, it's almost comical. And it is an opportunity, and I think for a lot of people it was, to realize that people still have day jobs, they still work in cubicles, there are still families and struggles here. And again, you know, Hawaii does have a very deep and rich history when it comes to immigration, when it comes to Native Hawaiian history and the overthrow, and any opportunity to peel that back just a little bit and show them how deep it can go if they were only interested in exploring it, I think is a great opportunity.
The question is whether those people who really need it most will actually understand it and be willing to accept it. Social scientists would probably tell us not, but that doesn't mean that it's not something that's good to be putting out there in social media. As you are now looking at this thing that continues to snowball, which includes, you know, boycott Hawaii and FU Hawaii and a few other choice words, you've got some choice words back?
Well, I would say that for the most part, I let them blow off steam because they think they're being funny, and I think they're funny in a different way, so it's a win-win situation. The great thing about social media is that you have the initial reaction, you have the backlash, and then the backlash against the backlash. It's a glorious cycle, and I think we're about in the middle of it. what's great about the Boycott Hawaii movement, and I'm making air quotes with my hand, is that it's primarily now dominated by people who think it's ridiculous and coming up with the funniest things about Boycott Hawaii rather than people who are still riled up about it. So it is actually an opportunity for a pretty large community to express their love for Hawaii, or in fact to educate other people about Hawaii, about why perhaps some people in Hawaii would not mind a boycott. So I think that, you know, again, the upsides are much greater than the downsides.
What are some of the funny things that you're hearing?
Well, the most common meme I've seen is, you know, boycott Hawaii, hashtag boycott Hawaii, hashtag please, you know, go ahead. Or
we're fine without you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, someone will say something angrily about bringing in refugees. And I think there are people responding saying, yes, please. You know, we are a land of aloha. We are welcoming in that way. So what people are seeing as a curse or a threat against us can be turned around sometimes to be shown to be an opportunity.
Right. And that's precisely what this whole exercise has been about. Now, likely when we hit the weekend, it will start to die off,
mm-hmm.
and it will be just another, you know, sort of smile about this last week. But is there something richer or deeper that you take from this at this moment in time, given the fact that Hawaii has taken the lead with the travel ban and the immigration ban, and the fact that we've seen all of this stuff happening in social media? Is there something more that we should be looking to from this?
Well, I think this outcry certainly gives you a point in history. Although internet memes come and go and people will forget it in a few days, I think that I'm going to always look back specifically at the fact that you had one of the few Native Hawaiian judges on the federal bench overturning this White House's executive order, arguing on behalf of a Syrian American, a Chinese American attorney general in the state where the previous president was born. And I think that the poetry of that, the significance of that, is so layered and so delicious that no really angry, raging Twitter user will be able to erase that for sure.
It's an elegant solution all the way around.
I think so.
Ryan Ozawa, thank you so much.
Mahalo.
Ryan Ozawa is the co-host of Hawaii Public Radio's tech-focused talk show, Bite Marks Cafe. He was an early adopter of Twitter and has controlled the handle @Hawaii since 2006.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Hawaii Pacific University, and Ulupono Initiative.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, the craft behind the creation of a successful children's book. But first, your quiz.
We just heard from Bite Marks co-host Ryan Ozawa, who accidentally found himself in the center of a Twitter storm. Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about wireless communication of a different sort. That system is wireless telegraphy, known at the time of its inception as the Marconi system. It was the creation of Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi, who developed the system in Bologna, Italy. Amazing, only a few years later, in 1902, Hawaii had a fully functioning system which serviced all of the main Hawaiian islands. That system was the brainchild of an American electrician with a big vision, and today we're looking for his name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and if you're first and right, you get the prize.
But you can hear it on the Pocono Telegraph by now. Everybody knows. You can hear it on
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
To communicate with children, you have to be able to get inside their minds, a feat of imagination that becomes second nature to children's book writers and illustrators. Kirsten Carlson's imaginative flights of fancy, where octopi tend their gardens and giraffes deal with their fear of heights, has adorned several books already, and she's getting ready for the annual Hawaii chapter of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators Conference. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Kirsten.
Aloha, Chris.
It's nice being in the place of reaching out to children, but it's kind of a trick, isn't it? I mean, you have to sort of think about what they perceive.
You definitely do. I actually probably never lost touch with my 8-year-old self, so I just access it when I want to write and illustrate.
That's good, because you'd have to get back there one way or the other, right?
Exactly.
Well, how does that play out in your work? What are the things that you want kids to see in your work?
For me personally, I have a real connection to nature and animals. So when I create my stories, they usually come in the form of pictures first, words later, and it typically involves an animal. So, for example, right now I'm working on 3 different stories that involve, one involves a seal, one involves a pigeon, and the other one involves a shark. It's completely different stories, but...
Well, give me a hint of what the shark story is, for example.
The shark story involves a little girl named Marcy, and all I'll share with you is that Marcy is the one that befriends the shark over a series of adventures she has with it.
So that gives you a starting point for story, and then you can kind of let the details fall into place after that, yeah?
Right. So for me personally, I have a science background, so what I like to do is I like to bring the nonfiction through the behavior of the animal into it, but the emotional connection usually through the story. In this case, it's Marcy's story about her relationship with the shark.
And when people talk about how they, you know, something is lost from childhood to adulthood, it usually has to do with things like that very natural emotional connection to animals. You know, find me a kid who doesn't love animals, right?
Right, exactly. I've loved them my entire life.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, why do you think people find it difficult to hang on to that the child inside them?
That's actually a really good question. I actually think the question that I would ask is, why do people forget how to tell stories? I think every child not only loves animals, unless they had a bad experience, but they also want to tell stories. And some people put that storytelling ability on a hook and forget about it and put it in the back of their virtual closet. And I think in particular, people who are creative writers or creative illustrators, they never lose touch with that side of them that wants to tell stories. We just channel it through, in my case, a 32-page picture book.
When you're crafting a 32-page picture book, you kind of time it for the length of time, I would think anyway, for the length of time it takes to read a story to a child at bedtime.
I actually don't know what the origin was of the 32 pages beyond the print parameters.
Oh, that's a standard in the business?
It is, yeah. Uh-huh. There are exceptions always, but a picture book is typically 32 pages in length. So picture books have their own rules and regulations, gates that you have to go through, and that just happens to be one of the parameters.
What are some of the other gates to go through? And this is new to me.
Okay, so in the world of picture books, usually they are 500 words or less, always. So mind you that everything I say has exceptions. I could pull out a book that has an exception. So 500 words or less, that the story could not be told in pictures alone or in words alone. And again, the 32...
That makes sense.
Yeah, in the 32-page standard sort of format. No regulations of if it's vertical or horizontal. Sometimes different publishing houses have different regulations or different parameters on that, excuse me. And then probably the final thing, which I just spaced on, I'll come back to it if I think of it. But yeah, those are the basic parameters.
Well, that's interesting for people to know, because I do think there are people out there who, you know, have a children's book in them and don't know it.
Yeah, I agree. I can't tell you the number of questions I get from people when I give presentations that come up to me after and go, hey, I have a picture book idea.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it'd be nice to encourage those people to go ahead and execute that idea, wouldn't it?
I firmly believe that we are storytellers at heart, and that even if you don't end up pursuing a career as a children's book writer or illustrator, learning how to tell a story is still a really valid way to communicate to other people. We've been doing it for thousands of years,
yeah,
from the days of painting in a cave, mm-hmm, to the storytellers around a campfire, to nowadays when we read books on a Kindle.
It would seem like a very good exercise for any parent just to create a story as a children's book and not worry so much about whether the mass market might like it or whether it's something to publish, but simply as something to do.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that would be great. I think every parent listening should do that, actually.
Well, let's see if we can start a whole groundswell with that.
That'd be awesome.
Was there a moment when you sort of realized that this was a path for you?
Yeah. So my background is in science, and I have many ways I bring in income. But one of them is the children's book aspect, and that bug first bit me back in the 90s. When I was working at Monterey Bay Aquarium, and they had their own publishing house.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, they were producing a children's book, and they had possibly approached me as the illustrator for it. I ended up not being able to take the project on, but I was bitten at that point. And I started investigating children's books. I made some mistakes on how you go about communicating with publishers, and then, mm-hmm, I found out about the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. Somebody told me about it. And it took me 2 years before I kind of caved in and said I would go to a meeting, because I'm not a big society group person. I want to kind of learn it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a conference in Los Angeles, the SCBWI conference in Los Angeles in 2002, and never looked back.
It sounds as if that's a path that a great many people might want to take.
I think more and more people do want to explore their storytelling self.
It's brought you a lot of pleasure, obviously, Kristen.
Yeah, definitely.
Terrific. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Kristen Carlson is a children's book illustrator and the Hawaii chapter of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators will meet March 25th and 26th at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Both parties are resisting President Trump's proposed budget, and for Hawaii, the state's congressional delegation says it's bad. Kirsten Downey is Civil Beats reporter based in D.C., and she joins us now for today's reality check. Aloha. Yesterday, Senator Brian Schatz said that the proposed budget is, you know, it's just that, a proposal. And he also said it's not going to happen. You've had the chance to review some of the other responses from the Hawaii delegation. What did they say that the effect of the proposed budget could be on Hawaii?
Well, they are very concerned about it. Senator Schatz's opinion on this is really particularly relevant because he serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee. So he will play a key role in voting on how the budget is developed and authorized. But they're concerned. President Trump said he, during his campaign, that he wanted to boost defense spending, and that's what this budget does. It also increases protections for veterans through the Veterans Administration, but it takes cut out of a great many other popular government agencies, the Department of Interior, the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, and it also takes out a lot of the things that we most value here in Washington, D.C., which are the NOAA grants that support coastal and marine research.
So we're looking at some of the things that potentially sound like they would be good for Hawaii. You talked about the defense spending, et cetera, but at the expense, literally, of a program like NOAA. Given the fact that this is just now a proposal and there's going to be a lot more discussion on this, what else from our congressional delegation did you hear in terms of resistance and also any resistance that you're hearing, particularly coming from the GOP?
The thing about cutting a budget is never popular with anyone. Cutting a budget so dramatically makes everyone unhappy. Everyone has different things that they want to protect, also different things that they would like to see cut. For example, Senator McCain thinks this doesn't give enough money for spending for the military. A lot of Democrats disagree. They want to see less money for the military and more for social spending. These are the kinds of balancing things that our congressional delegation will be watching carefully, because they want to make sure that Hawaii's interests are protected.
We would hear that probably in any political year where there's any budget coming out. Is there something, though, that makes it particularly upsetting for this year, aside from the fact that we're talking about this coming from President Trump?
The cuts he's proposing are draconian in a number of ways, eliminating funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, a lot of us know and love the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Eliminating funding for the United States Institute of Peace, which was the organization that Senator Spark Matsunaga had championed the creation of. The National Endowments for the Humanities, the National Endowments for the Arts. Some of the things that are on the chopping block here are things that are quite near and dear to people's hearts. A lot of the other funding is more difficult to determine how exactly each cabinet official would make those cuts. I think the thing that's really interesting that we can say about the Trump presidency is that we're all paying a lot more attention to the process by how the federal government works. So what we see here is that the president proposes a budget. Congress is what authorizes and decides what the spending levels would be. Here's another case where we see checks and balances.
A lot of people are going to hope that is all true. Kirsten, sorry, we got to go, but thanks very much for checking in from Washington.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring D.C.-based reporter Kirsten Downey. And as we like to do on a Friday, we take a look at what our news department is working on for the coming week. And to help us with that, HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, just walked into the room and sat down, put on some headphones, and here you are. So next week, we're still talking about the intersection of art and life.
Aloha, Bethann. Yeah, this is a really interesting point, and it's sort of the idea of the art of making a living in the art world, right? So the Honolulu Biennial is on, getting a lot of attention, a lot of activity in the art world generally in town, talking a bit of a buzz about an art boom, really, here in Honolulu. Some corporate money around that is supportive of some various projects, retail spaces, condo projects, offices, other businesses, even out to the airport. But in the midst of all of that, can that add up to making a living as an artist?
As many an artist would like to know the answer
yes,
to that one.
Yes, exactly. And you've got that sort of, ooh, it sounds so nice, but is that possible? And do are people more able to do that now than used to be the case? Noe Tanigao is a really good person to speak to this. She's a visual artist herself, in addition to being a reporter for us. But she's going to take that up and give it a little perspective and come back with some answers next week.
Find out whether it's really still true or maybe ever true. If you follow your passion, the money will come.
That's a good concept, yes.
Okay, well, as we're talking about money, that leads us back into a conversation about the legislature, which still continues. We've got a little better than a month until that first week in May when we say goodbye.
Yeah, exactly. And so, as you know, now we get to that interesting stage of closer examination on a more focused number of topics, and a lot of committee work coming this coming week, for example. So, House Committee on Transportation hearing bill on the rail transit surcharge on the general excise tax. Over on the Senate, more about Airbnb and similar rentals, splitting the transient accommodation tax to each county for enforcement of rentals and adding money for that. Surcharge on tax on brokers for transient accommodation. So there are a lot of issues floating around there related to money.
We're really finding out what that word surcharge truly means every time you
Boy.
Hear it.
I tell you. And meanwhile, City Council, here's another one, the measure that would ban the use of electronic devices under certain conditions like, oh, say when you're crossing the street. Anyway, Wayne Yoshioka's over all of those as well.
And we're going to have any special music folks coming in this week?
I tell you, sometimes you get someone who's a tremendous musician and has a social story as well. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Bonnie Raitt coming to Maui, coming to Honolulu, and talking to Dave Lawrence.
Ooh, looking forward to that one. And everything else that we just talked about, too. Thanks, Bill Dorman.
You bet.
HPR's news director is Bill Dorman. He joins us every Friday with a preview of coming attractions. On a Friday, we also read from your letters and email.
And after yesterday's town square on tax fairness, we heard this from Yvonne Leiser from Kapa'au on the Big Island.
Much could be done with gentle education around GET and TAT. Both seem to be casually underreported. Also, following up on internet and catalog sales, like the upcoming change with Amazon, would be a move in the right direction. Hawaii doesn't make it easy for an individual to report this use tax.
About the program realignment, the Natural Energy Lab of Hawaii sent this via Twitter. Very happy that HPR decided to air the conversation in the evening, too. Great show.
Well, thank you very much. And in response to the tweets Ryan Ozawa has been receiving, as he's the holder of the handle at Hawaii, Aubrey in Honolulu said, "That's some serious hate. I'm embarrassed for my country."
Thanks for your feedback. If you've got a comment to share, call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Around many a kitchen table, families are talking with their graduating high school seniors about where they'll go to college. National Decision Day is May 1st. That's the day by which most schools require an answer whether the students they've accepted will actually attend. Of course, the affordability of tuition, room and board are big factors, but even with the escalating price of a college education, a new report by the UH Economic Research Organization released this week may nudge families and students into taking loans to pay for it. It shows, that is, the report shows, that women with a bachelor's degree make more over their working lifetimes than men with the same degree, but men make more than women once postgraduate degrees are factored in. I talked with economist Jonathan Page, the director of analytics for the UH Economic Research Organization, or UHERO, earlier today about those numbers and why there's still a disparity between men and women.
There is this kind of long-standing difference between men and women in lifetime earnings. So when we estimate the lifetime earnings using data from 2000 to 2015, we're also including people that are nearing retirement in some of these calculations to estimate the life cycle earnings. So we are getting individuals who have been in the workforce for quite a long time. And so some of the gender disparities that are even historical come into this calculation.
Especially though, that seems to show up ironically, at the postgraduate level. Why there?
We don't touch on that much in this paper. In general, a lot of the differences in incomes between the genders relate to some of the occupational choices, depending on the major, are more represented by women or respectively more represented by men. And so this selection into different career choices is highly correlated with the incomes that we observe.
How deep did you go into the data from just, you know, UH in terms of those choices?
Unfortunately, the data set that we worked with is excellent for estimating these life cycle earnings, but it's not very good for us to be able to do a deep dive on where exactly did these individuals graduate from. And so we used a standard approach to make some assumptions of what earnings would be coming out of school from UH. Now, fortunately, you know, Hawaii P20 is in the process of collecting quite a bit of data on UH graduates, and so it is my hope that, you know, in the future we'll be able to have much better estimates of UH graduates in particular.
So then I got to ask you, how can people rely on this kind of data, especially when you've got college counselors and parents and a lot of families which will be making some choices very, very soon about where their kids are going to go to school?
So that's a great question. I would just say that some information is better than no information. And this is data that we have analyzed using the best tools and the safest process possible. So this is a safe estimate. We've been conservative. There are many benefits that we are not considering. We are conservative on the costs that the student himself is foregoing in going to school. So I would be comfortable in communicating this as a lower bound of what you should expect on average.
You mentioned that there were some benefits not included in this, and it's quite conservative. Can you talk a little bit more about that to give that a little bit more shape in terms of what benefits you didn't look at?
Sure. There are a variety of non-monetary benefits that graduates of college do in general get. There are many studies over the past decade looking at one, for example, by Bruce, who suggests that 30% of returns to schooling in middle age are acquired through marriage, that there's a lot of this marriage sorting that people do in college or in their careers that they have access to because of college. And so there's a lot of these interesting little effects that happen sort of because you kind of went to college. College also has the opportunity to expose you to different cultures, to help you learn more about your world. And as you learn more outside of just where you have come from, your perspective on life expands.
So some of those maybe softer skills or perspective-shaping ideas that come out of college, that's a completely different idea from what someone really can expect to make based on only having the degree. I think we understand that. But then there's the idea, Jonathan, of debt and tremendous debt that kids and families take on, especially for those postgraduate years if they choose to go on to grad school. Those numbers also don't seem to be in this at all in terms of offsetting or being offset by what they get by having that degree.
Well, that's not exactly right. So in the paper, we do look at the cost of tuition and fees, and these loans are largely to offset tuition and fees. The other side of loans is to offset foregone earnings. So you give up working some to be in school, and so you often take loans. I know that I did to be able to survive, you know, just going to school. And those are costs that we do consider. So when we're talking about the expected benefit that you get from school, we're not just talking about your benefit, but we're talking about your benefit here, you know, net of these costs of tuition fees and the earnings that you forego.
So let's take, for example, someone who is in medical school, and as we actually had someone tell us a couple years ago on the program, was going to be graduating with student loans of about, you know, $260,000. If you're at that level, how then do you expect to have your earnings offset given the time relative to pay off those student loans?
Yeah, so this is why the emphasis on the paper is on life course earnings. So I, too, have a similar level of debt, but I am confident that my earnings will pay for that debt and more. So the cost in terms of the debt is huge, and it is staggering. But in terms of lifetime earnings, we earn much more than that amount over our life. So, you know, $250,000 sounds like quite a bit. Once you consider, you know, assume you're earning $50,000 a year, you know, that would be, you know, just five times that you'd be able to get up to that level. And so in one's life, you accumulate or spend quite a bit more than these values that we kind of throw around. So it can be hard to wrap our heads around these numbers when we talk about a more than $1 million benefit. Often we're comparing that internally to maybe an annual salary, and that's just kind of the wrong comparison to make.
Jonathan, forgive me, but when you talk about making $50,000, when in Hawaii that would mean you're going to be sharing an apartment or a condo or a house with a whole bunch of people to be able to make it, and then having to paying off student loans, a lot of people are caught in that position and feeling like they're not really moving forward.
So I understand that. I guess what I would say is what we are talking about in this paper are kind of the averages. So if you look at on average, the benefits far outweigh the costs. That's not to say that there will be some individuals who face costs that to them far exceed the benefits that they are seeing, at least immediately. It is my expectation that over their lifetime that they would be able to pay off the debts and that their earnings would exceed what they would have got just with high school.
And some folks would say, yes, especially that would be true if they move away from Hawaii for a little bit to be able to make sure that all of that gets paid off, even if they want to come back to Hawaii too. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bethany.
Jonathan Page is the Director of Analytics for the UH Economic Research Organization, or UHERO. He is the lead author of the report, Financial Benefits to a University of Hawaii Education. If you'd like to have a look at the numbers, you can find a link on our website or our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we were thinking about Hawaii's first wireless communication system. That is, if you don't count canoes and sailing ships. The system we're thinking of was a network of wireless telegraphy stations, essentially a telegraph that did not require a wire. This technology, known as the Marconi system, was invented in Europe at the end of the 19th century and was being adopted by Western navies and private yachting clubs. It was an entrepreneurial American electrician from Buffalo, New York, who realized the system's potential for Hawaii while touring the islands in 1899. Upon returning to the United States, he reached out to the Marconi Company and secured a franchise license to develop a network of Marconi transmitters across Hawaii. The first link of that network came online in November of 1900, when a message was sent wirelessly from Oahu to Molokai. In March of 1901, the Inter-Island Telegraph Company opened for business under the leadership of its president and founder, Fred J. Cross, who is the answer to today's question. Nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. And if you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
Daniel Ho is a multi-instrumentalist and producer who's determined to stretch the boundaries of local music, merging traditional and modern sounds in search of a new kind of fusion. He's coming to Hawaii this weekend with one of Japan's most celebrated electric guitar masters to present new music from their recording, Electric Island Acoustic Sea. The guitarist is Tak Matsumoto, and Daniel Ho is on the phone with us from California. Good morning, Daniel.
Aloha.
Hi.
How are you doing, Chris?
All right. Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Sure. You know, back in the day, Daniel, when you heard a shamisen, it was used for Japanese music. When you heard an ukulele, it was used for Hawaiian music. And those boundaries seem to have been broken in recent years, yeah?
A little bit. Broken or maybe just stretched.
Well, I mean, you know, I've heard things like the Indian instrument tabla used on contemporary jazz, but there's a lot of potential if you take an instrument out of its supposed home, don't you think?
Yes, I really enjoy using cultural instruments and infusing new compositions and cross-cultural things, tabla, polyrhythms, and different things like that, and seeing like the end result.
Well, because a sound is a sound, right? If it works, it works.
Yes, and in a lot of ways, like, for instance, the tabla has a lot of voices. I don't know exactly how many, maybe 25, but yeah. A lot of those voices, low tones and high tones, could be similar, used in similar functions as the parts of a drum set, toms and snare and hat and kick and so on.
Right.
So there's neat ways to use them.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could play a melody on tabla, just as an example.
Yes. Yeah.
In your Amazing. Collaboration with Tak Matsumoto, excuse me, he's, you know, he plays a overdriven electric guitar, you know, Les Paul with lots of sustain, lots of reverb, a really rich electric guitar sound. And you associate that with, you know, electric keyboards, bass, drums, things like that. But you've added other instruments, haven't you?
Yes. In working with Tak, our concept of the album Electric Island Acoustic Sea was to surround his electric sound with traditional instruments from the islands of Hawaii and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So I primarily do acoustic music,
mm-hmm.
and I use a lot of Hawaiian instruments, you know, flat key guitar. I play ipuheke quite a bit on a lot of my recordings, and ukulele, flat key guitar, a kala'au. I have an instrument called a bongo lele, bass ukulele, different things like that. And,
sure.
We also use taiko, and I have a sanshin ukulele. A sanshin is a predecessor to the shamisen. It's an Okinawan instrument, a snakeskin instrument, mm-hmm. and I have an ukulele made by a sanshin builder in Okinawa, and I use that on a couple of songs, and just try to come up with sounds that are interesting, and I'm sure in some way they've been done before, and we use that to color our original compositions with these cultural flavors.
Because it is like, you know, once you've got your chords and your notes, then you do have many options about timbre, about what, as you said, what color to paint those chords and notes in.
Exactly. And I think the use of these traditional instruments is a fresh take. For instance, instead of using congas to play something, I might use a bongo lele or a ipuheke mm-hmm. to do a similar pattern, and it gives it a fresh sound, even though the rhythm might be very similar or identical to what a conga would play.
Well, Daniel, let's listen to just a sample of your new recording. This is a Moko Koro. We're going to play just a few seconds of it, and then we'll see what you think about it.
Okay.
Well, Daniel, that's what the electric guitar, particularly the Les Paul, is known for, right? That long, long wailing sustain notes, and it was kind of your job as producer to paint colors around it, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, and the idea in composing the song Mago Koro in Japanese means true heart, and Tap speaks, his voice is his electric guitar, and in the sustain and his inflections and articulations and the way he just makes the guitar cry, it it's sort of a song that expresses the emotions you'd feel in solitude, like deep emotions. And I left a lot of space in the music, you know, just the sparse acoustic piano part, to allow him to just be free to express the melody in the way that he wanted to.
And that's very much the kind of this. That particular tune is very much the kind of thing where you do want a, some space around it. It would be very easy to overcrowd a melody like that.
Yes, I'm really good at staying out of the way.
Hey, don't knock it. That's a rare enough skill in a producer, because producers tend to think they have to produce, right?
We don't get paid by the note. I wonder if Mozart got paid by the note.
Well, I've heard
that
a few.
Too many notes.
I've heard a few musicians that I suspected of being paid by the note, and it generally doesn't improve the music that much. I mean, in this case, you know, Matsumoto is a virtuoso, but there's no overt displays of virtuosity in what we just heard. Just long, really pretty, rich sounding notes. Yeah.
Yes, there's a very deliberate way that he presents his music, and he means every note, and he's doing something. Every note is coming from somewhere and going somewhere and connected in some way. And even the sounds that he has, the electric guitar, the palette of sounds is infinite, really.
Yeah.
For me, an acoustic guitar, a string guitar, you know, you put a mic in front of it, you got a good guitar, and I don't use much effects or anything. I just try to capture the sound in its purest form.
Yeah.
But electric guitar is quite different, and I think that's what I learned most on this project, was that, you know, you can drive it and make a lot of distortion. You can make it clean and everywhere in between.
That's what makes it fun, Daniel. Thanks very much for talking with us. Daniel Ho and guitarist Tak Matsumoto will perform at Blue Note Hawaii on Sunday evening in support of their new album, Electric Island Acoustic Sea. Tak's guitar is a featured instrument surrounded by traditional instruments like ukulele, slack key guitar, ipuheke, taiko, koto, and shamisen.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
As we head into the weekend, there are a lot of activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us at this time in the show to look at events in our community that are under the radar. And since it's the weekend, it's time to head for a book sale.
Yes, there's always one happening somewhere.
Good.
Saturday and Sunday, the Friends of Manoa Library Spring Book Sale is happening. And most books, CDs and DVDs begin at $1. And there will also be collectible books available. Proceeds support the library's programs. The sale is Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Sunday 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the library, 2716 Woodlawn Avenue.
I'm a big fan of those, Derek, because you can get some great bargains, books, CDs, and movies on DVD.
Yeah, things that you,
Exactly.
Hidden gems.
Hidden gems, there
yes,
you go.
Yes, yes. There is a cultural celebration in Honoka'a tomorrow. The Hawaiian Cultural Center of Hamakua celebrates its one-year anniversary in Honoka'a. The Olamau Ikapono Festival is tomorrow at the historic Botelho Building from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and it's free.
I always like to hear that part.
Yes, yeah, and yes, cultural celebration. Sunny Lim and other musicians will be there along with Hula Halau, plus craft booths, displays, cultural activities, and food. I know you like to hear. We all like to hear that part, too.
Yeah, what's not to like, right? And there's going to be some amateur musicians performing classical music for free Sunday in Kailua. I think I'm going to head for that.
Yeah, the Oahu Civic Orchestra is a 60-piece community orchestra, and its members are amateur musicians from all walks of life. And the feature concert features music by Bach, Mendelssohn, Brahms, and more. And it's happening Sunday at St. John Vianney. The address is 920 Keolu Avenue in Kailua from 4 to 5 p.m., and that's free.
Sounds pretty good, Derek. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Well, that's going to do it for this week on this St. Patrick's Day. But coming up on Monday, we're going to talk about the legal viewpoint in opposition to SB 1129. That's the medical aid in dying bill. Representative Marcus Oshiro will be here.
And a Hawaii Island veterinarian will trace the history of the Hawaiian horse.
We like to hear from you, and you can call us anytime you like. Our talk back line is always available at 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post your comments on Facebook, too. Our page is Hawaii Conversation, or if you like Twitter, we're there at HI Conversation, or you can find me at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again or get another past show or links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Jillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty is our production assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you Monday when we pick up the conversation.